I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with NPR Illinois Community Voices. I'm your host, Brandon Davis of Front Row Classics. And hard to believe, but it's our first show of 2021. We made it, Eric.
We did. It was a long haul.
Yeah. How's it going?
It's going really well. So far, so good.
Yeah, great. So we have, actually, for our first episode of 2021, joining us a very special guest for the first time for the Front Row Network, someone who I go back quite a ways with. I go back to a high school with, Kelly Lorenz. How's it going, Kelly?
Hi, it's going great. It's going great. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Kelly and I did high school speech, theater, and choir together. So we both are very well versed in musicals and musical theater and all of that. So I've been wanting to get her on for a long time. So I'm glad you finally joined us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I've listened to your podcasts and they're great. I mean, you know, and you've gotten to interview some amazing people, which is awesome. So I just feel honored to be a part of it all.
Awesome. Awesome. So Kelly, one thing that we do ask people who join us for the first time, and it's probably the hardest question we'll ask you, what's your favorite movie?
Ooh, my favorite movie. This one is actually ranks in like the top five, I would say. But like, honestly, one of my favorite movies is probably White Christmas, especially since we're in the Christmas season right now. It was a favorite of my mom's growing up, and it was one of those movies where she was like, I can literally put it on any time of the day, no matter what the season, even though it's Christmas. And I kind of feel the same way as her. So yeah, I would definitely say probably White Christmas and Sound of Music is probably either my second or third.
That is not a bad choice, I'll tell you. So actually, and we buried the lead, but yeah, the movie that we are talking about today is The Sound of Music from 1965. And I can't believe it. I've been doing that. Eric, you've been with me for about a year and a half, but I've been doing this for about 5 years and we haven't gotten around to it yet. I feel like I need to slap myself on the wrist or something. But I'm glad.
Hey, there's only so much time.
I know. When you only do like one or two movies a month, it's like, where do you go?
Sure.
We finally got around to it. So I don't think we even need to give a plot for people because I think it's in everybody's DNA by now. Based off of a Broadway musical from 1959, actually goes back further than that. It was Maria von Trapp wrote an autobiography, which became a German film, which became a Broadway musical in 1959 starring Mary Martin. And then 20th Century Fox bought the film rights to it pretty quickly after that, but it sat on the shelves for a few years and then they finally got around to it. And little did they know that it would become the biggest blockbuster of its time. And actually I think surpassed Gone with the Wind as the highest grossing movie of all time. So Kelly, actually let's start with you. Do you remember the first time you saw The Sound of Music?
Yes. The Sound of Music was actually the first movie musical that I can recall watching. I'm sure I probably watched like White Christmas and other old movie musicals before, but that was the first one that really registered for me. And I had the double VHS set that I watched all the time as a kid. And then coincidentally, it just worked out that LCT, Lincoln Community Theater, was doing Sound of Music when I was like the age of Gretel and I had been watching it at home. So that was actually the first musical that I auditioned for. And then I did not get Gretel, but my mother and I still went to see the stage production. And that was actually the first stage musical that I can recall seeing as well. So this kind of catapulted my love for theater and musicals and everything else. So yeah.
Great. Yeah. Eric, do you remember?
I don't remember specifically the first time. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like this movie for a while there was sort of on an annual basis. Like it was kind of like the Wizard of Oz that would get shown around Thanksgiving, but this might have been shown, The Sound of Music might have been shown in the springtime of every year. So it was sort of this annual event that it would get shown on TV. And if that, whenever it was on TV, it was on in my house. So it was just always around. So I don't remember specifically the first time sitting down and watching the movie, but if it was on being broadcast, we were watching it at my house. And then I think you mentioned it, Brandon, everyone's kind of had this, has a portion of this movie at least in their consciousness. I do remember like second grade music class, they teach you Do Re Mi. I mean, that's just a song that kids get taught growing up, or at least, you know, the ages that we are when we did. So I remember this movie just being a part of the public consciousness, you know, growing up in sort of the Midwest and loving it. You know, there wasn't anything goofy or ooh, that's a musical about it either.
Yeah, it was, I'm trying to think back for me. It's one of those, I think I mentioned it when I talked about The Wizard of Oz, it's one of those movies that feels like it was always there, and I don't really remember like the first time viewing it, but it was one of those double-decker VHSs that we had in our house. It was like that and My Fair Lady and Fiddler on the Roof. It was like those, you know, those three-hour ones that took two VHSs, so you always had it was a time commitment. But yeah, I remember loving it from the beginning, and I don't remember if it was the first movie musical I ever saw. I'm sure, I think it would probably have been Wizard of Oz, which you consider a movie musical, but this was the first like Broadway musical that was turned into a movie that I saw, and it stuck with me. And it's funny watching this the last time, since I rewatched it for this podcast, it's just such a gorgeously made movie, and it's so beautifully shot. And it's so well put together. And I did a list last year for our website of like seven movie musicals that I thought were actually better than the stage versions. And this movie was at the top of my list. I think it's better than the stage version, actually, because I think the stage version's fine. I've seen it a few times, but I think this cut some things that needed to be cut. It added a few things that worked well. I think overall as a whole, it works better. Kelly, I think you agree.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I would definitely say I'm more familiar with the movie than the stage version, and I think it's because I love the movie more. I've seen the stage version a few times. I've never like had a chance to be in it. I would love to be Maria someday, but yeah. It is, I do love the movie version much more. I mean, we can get into it later if we have time, but like the songs that were cut and replaced and the order of the songs is completely different, and then just all of the added like meat to the script and everything that's added for the movie is just so much more realistic than the stage version. And that, I know that was a huge thing when they were first making the movie, was like, the stage version is so sugary, how do we alter that? And it was very cool to just read up about how the screenwriter for this for the movie kind of incorporated everything, the memoirs, the German film, and the stage show, and just kind of took it and mushed it all together into what the movie is. And I think it's just so good.
Yeah, well, it's directed by Robert Wise, who just 4 years earlier directed another great movie musical, West Side Story. And what got me this time, and we'll get into favorite scenes later, but the way it starts to me is reminiscent of West Side Story, because at the beginning of West Side Story, you have all the aerial shots of New York, and it's just the sounds of the city. And of course, this time it's the aerial shots of the mountains and just the sound of nature until the orchestra actually comes in. So it's masterfully done. But let's actually get into talking about the actors involved in the movie and the cast. And it always amazes me every time that this was only Julie Andrews' third movie. And, you know, for someone to just totally jump into becoming a screen star the way that she did just impresses me to no end. And boy, did she make her mark. Eric, we'll start with you. What are your opinions of Julie Andrews as Maria?
Iconic. I mean, and when you think of Julie Andrews, you're going to think of one of two things immediately. It's The Sound of Music and Mary Poppins. And I struggled to, watching this through, more iconic? Which one is Julie Andrews better in? Because it's really a tough comparison between those two movies, and she's got it all. I mean, you start with the fantastic singing voice, and you add in an actress who can wear her emotions on her sleeve and have a genuine sweetness to her, who can also move around a good bit. She had it all in spades, and it is kind of strange that she was sort of just this. It's like she sprang from the skull of Zeus as this fully formed movie star, but is absolutely.
Yeah, Kelly.
I've been a huge Julie Andrews fan since I knew who Julie Andrews was and I saw this movie. I was a huge fan of Mary Poppins growing up, and I just finished both of her memoirs during the pandemic, since I've had so much time, and it's so amazing to read about her early life too. With her, she had like a lot of family troubles, but she didn't realize it till later. And then it's like she had all of this like emotional ammo throughout her life, like built up to use, and it was like not until she started becoming like a film star and then like exploring those emotions and I love all her upbringing with vaudeville. I mean, that's I think why she has such a wide range in what she's capable of, because of everything that she grew up with. And I love reading about her insecurities too, how like nervous she was for all of these scenes, and she was like a sponge. Every person she worked with, she absorbed everything that they gave her and everything she learned. And she talks too a lot about Christopher Plummer, like them working off of each other, him helping her, and like how nervous she was to work with him because he was such a established stage, real Shakespearean actor. And she's just like, I am this vaudeville, has a great voice, dances okay. But like, yeah, she was so nervous, but so determined. And I just love her to pieces.
Yeah, it's funny. She kind of has this sugary sweet image that's been given to her over the years, but if you really look at the movie, Maria's very salty, and she's very very salt of the earth, and she doesn't take guff from anybody. And I love that about her performance. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, Shirley, of course, you know, she was untried when they shot this because Mary Poppins hadn't been released yet. And it was Walt Disney who actually allowed them to go and view footage of Mary Poppins, where they saw that she was photogenic. Because I was reading some of the other options for this movie, and they had originally thought of Doris Day for the part. They had originally thought of Audrey Hepburn. They had thought of Grace Kelly. And so really, really interesting people. And, but Julie Andrews just seems perfect. And I think if you had cast someone like Doris Day, who was a great singer, but it would have become a Doris Day movie. And with Julie Andrews, she kind of disappears into the part of Maria. And she's infectious throughout the whole movie, and the way that she is with the kids. And you believe that she makes this household come alive. It doesn't feel forced at all. And I think that's her biggest contribution to the movie, aside from the gorgeous voice.
No, absolutely. And Kelly, you mentioned having to act against this trained Shakespearean actor, and she gives as good as she gets. You know, she goes toe to toe. The characters go toe to toe with each other, but she holds her own in every scene that she's in, and not in a greedy way either. You know, she does seem like she's a very generous actor throughout this whole film.
Yeah, absolutely. Generous actor, I feel like, is a really good way to put it, because you see her, like, she's just in it 100%, and you see her in scenes with other people, and she's giving them, like, everything that she thinks that they need and what the scene needs. And I think also just her presence, like, she was very friendly with the children. She played games with them, so it was almost like she played that role when the camera wasn't rolling, and then when it was time for them to just, like, jump into action, it was, you know, just carried from off camera to on camera as well. So
it really amazed me. This was the first time I'd watched it all the way through in a while, so to really watch her arc from the beginning to the end, it's really, really amazing. Well, let's move on though to, were you going to add something, Eric?
Yeah, I was just going to say, too, yeah. And in the third act, the character is completely different.
Yeah.
They go away for their honeymoon, and she comes back as the mother. And it's a difficult thing to transform in the way that she does. But she pulls that off, too, and carries sort of the weight of the head of the household now.
Yeah, and she doesn't buckle during those final scenes, you know, where they're being chased by the Nazis. She has no problem talking to Herr Zeller and all those people, you know. It's really, you know, she does change, but she's still that spunky, you know, rebellious nun that she always was. So let's move on, though, and talk about Captain Von Trapp, played by Christopher Plummer. And I watched it again, and I think this is one of the reasons why I think this movie is better than the Broadway version, because in the Broadway version, Captain Von Trapp will come on, say a few lines, walk off, come on again, say a few lines, and just be, he's almost like a caricature early on. But it took an actor of such, you know, such warmth and brilliance as Christopher Plummer to really give this guy three dimensions, and he really does that. And just when I think back to the part, you know, where he walks in the house and hears the children singing, that's a very quick turn for that character to make, but through his face you see the whole transformation and you believe it. And I don't think a lot of actors could do that. Kelly, we'll start with you on Christopher Plummer.
When I watch this now, I don't know, I mean, of course, the competition is crazy in Oscar season, but like at least to get a supporting role nomination for him, I just thought that the way he, yeah, just taking the character and recreating it into something that has more substance, and it makes you understand why Maria falls in love with the captain. And just watching some documentaries, Christopher Plummer actually sat down with the screenwriter and was like, I have ideas to make him more substantial. And it was like exactly how you said. He was like, he comes in, he says a few angry things, and then he leaves, and then he comes back in and says a couple things and leaves. So there wasn't much to him. And it's, his arc is so beautiful too. When you get to the final scene, or the scene with him and Rio when they are together, you see him become this boyish, like, just, it's a completely different person. And yeah, he's fantastic. And as a little 5-6-year-old growing up, I never had any crushes on any of the Von Trapp boys. I only had a crush on Christopher Plummer. So
well, Friedrich and Kurt aren't much competition for the captain, I'll tell you.
Friedrich tries to be, but he's just not there yet.
He's still impossible. No. Eric, what about you?
I love what Kelly said, that he's just got this great arc. And you do have to credit that to, I'm sure that some of it was in the script. And we talked earlier about the manipulations of the script from musical to movie, and whether Plummer was involved in it or not. You know, I didn't do as much research, obviously, to know that, but they hit it just right. I mean, this is a guy who's broken. His, you know, wife was obviously his world, even beyond his love for his seven children, until this other person comes into his life and reawakens it. So you can understand why that character would be angry, and understand why that character would be written that way in the musical version. But Christopher Plummer brings that vulnerability to the role too. And the tear-jerking moments in this movie, he owns them. I mean, it's always about when he rediscovers that he has, or discovers for the first time that he's basically abandoned his children, and comes around on that. Or when he discovers that he's in love with this woman who brought all that into his life. And when he's playing the hero, I mean, those are all moments of deep, touching emotion. And it's hard to pull that off. And Christopher Plummer, he just does it so well. There's this softness to him. You want to kind of stare into his eyes, because he's, you know, he seems like he's got it all. So I agree, Kelly. He probably should have gotten at least a nomination for this. And it's kind of a shame that he didn't.
Yeah, I to me, the what got me this time was At the end when he's singing Edelweiss at the concert, and when he gets choked up when he's trying to finish. And I'm like, that is so beautifully played, because it's not overdone. You see it all. It's very subtle, you know, it's not, he doesn't bring on the waterworks. It's just, you feel the weight of that moment when he does it. And he plays those scenes, you know, when Captain Von Trapp, you know, is really fighting against where Austria is heading politically. You really feel the dread of that, because nowhere, you know, with Marie and the children, you don't feel that, you know, he's sort of your link of what's going on in the real world, and you feel the weight of that on his shoulders, especially in those later scenes.
Yeah. And even before that, when he snaps on Max and says, don't you ever say things like that again, it gives you a glimpse into, this guy is a hero. You know, not only was he a war hero, in the German Navy, but he's going to be a hero throughout the whole film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, let's move on. Let's talk about the kids, and we don't have time to talk about all seven of them, but, let's just throw out like our favorite. Kelly, do you have a favorite of the Von Trapp children?
I always loved how sassy Brigida was. She was always, I was like a kid growing up too, watching the movie. I was like, I want to be as sassy and just independent as that little girl. So yeah, I would probably say she was my favorite.
Yeah, I love, well, and Angela Cartwright, for people who are fans of the TV show Lost in Space, she was Penny. So I think of all the seven actors, she might have been the most like seasoned at that time. I think most of them were unknown, but she really was the one who had kind of already, she was kind of a showbiz vet by that time. But yeah, she's great. Eric, do you have a favorite?
You know, growing up and watching the movie, Gretel is the cute little one, has cute little scenes. But at some point in the early 2000s, the actress, make sure I got her name right, Charmaine Carr, uh-huh, wrote a book called Forever Liesel. And she went on a little book tour, and my wife happened to be working at a bookstore at the time, and she came and did a presentation about her book and just had these wonderful stories to tell about this film production. And now I can't watch this movie and not hear those stories. One of my favorite though is, and I hope we have time to cover a couple of these, because they're really quite funny, but
sure.
Gretel, American actress, but they filmed some of this stuff on location. She didn't like the food that was being served, so she'd only eat bread the entire time. And they filmed out of sequence. And so over the 6 months, all these children changed sizes and shapes. Well, Gretel, she was eating nothing but bread, and so she became heavier. And one of the final scenes that they filmed is the So Long Farewell, where Liesel has to pick her up and carry her up the stairs. And she said that this kid had, you know, gone from 40 pounds to like 63 pounds. And she's like, they put me in these heels, had me climb three flights of stairs. She's like, my legs were never more sore than after we filmed that scene. So for me, that character, I can't not watch the movie and see her like struggling to carry this 5-year-old up these flights of stairs. But at the same time, it's a really fun character who has the arc with Rolf and the wonderful scene in the gazebo that I'm sure we'll talk about later on too. So one of my favorite characters in the movie.
Yeah, and I like Kurt. I like Dwayne Chase's Kurt. I think he just makes funny faces. He's the comic relief, and I think he's great. And I think I saw an interview where Julie Andrews said every time he walked in, she just wanted to, you know, pinch his cheeks or whatever. And, but yeah, one of my favorite lines is when he says, "I wonder what grass tastes like," after they get back from visiting the Abbey. But yeah, all the kids though are fantastic, and they each have great, great little moments, you know. And unfortunately, Charmaine Carr passed away a couple years ago, and so did Heather Menzies, who played Louisa, who was married to Robert Urich, and they. So very sad that they both died way too soon, but all seven of these kids are fantastic. The other characters though, I wanted to mention Uncle Max, played by Richard Hayden, a great little supporting comic part. And he's kind of the, it's interesting. I think in the actual stage version, Uncle Max is a little more political, and in the movie they make him more apolitical. And but I think it works well, because I think it's more frustrating for Captain Von Trapp to have someone be, you know, as apolitical as Max is, because that really gets under his skin. Kelly, what are your opinions on Uncle Max?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And also cutting the song, oh, what's it called?
That his one big song. Number in the stage.
Yeah, the one,
yeah,
that
he has his own.
Yeah, there's no way to stop it. That's the song I'm thinking of. It's him and Elsa sing it together to the captain about saying there's no way to stop it. Germany is just in Austria, it's going to happen. So I think like cutting that song definitely helped make him that. And it also keeps you wondering and not just knowing which side he's on, which I also think is a good aspect, especially since he helps them sneak out and all of that. So it keeps you as an audience member wondering like what is actually going to happen with Uncle Max. And I think that's a good thing to have in the movie to question. So
yeah, Eric.
I viewed Max through a different lens when I watched this movie, and I don't want to be I want to be sensitive to this, but I had my wife Google this as we were watching the movie, but I think that Max was written to potentially be a Jewish character as well. So there were a couple of things that I think in the way the character is written that would be come across as sort of stereotypically Jewish, which left a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth. But at the same time, it informs you about the character of Captain Von Trapp, that he's got this Jewish friend in his life. And we know what that means for what's coming in the Third Reich. So it's played subtly. And apparently this was the intention of when they wrote the character, that it wouldn't be overt, but that you would sort of associate it with a Jewish person. So it's a complicated character. I think a lot more complicated than when you watch the film for the first time, who is just this guy who, you know, puts on shows and is trying to sign the family. You know, he's just trying to, make a buck. He's more than that. He's trying to figure out how to survive, you know? And I think that there's an arc there too, that shows you that, you know, the world became a lot more complicated, and this is a guy just trying to figure out as he goes along. He doesn't have the luxury of being a war hero or having a route of escape. So I think there's a way more depth to that character than initially comes across. And I noticed it this time through, and I think the performance is subtle, but it's there all the way through.
Well, and what's that line he says? What's going to happen is going to happen. Just don't let it happen to you.
Right.
So you're right. He is trying to survive as best he can. The other character that stood out to me this time when I watched, though, was the Baroness, played by Eleanor Parker. And, you know, she's thought of as kind of the villainess of the piece and all that. But I love her performance, because I think she's very charming, and yet she can really just slide in a real bitchy comment every now and then that just really, really is played incredibly well. And yeah, by the time you know Maria comes back, you're just ready for her to leave and be out of the picture. But I think she really brings a nice sarcastic wit to the movie when it's most needed. I think as you have all the stuff between Maria and the kids, and then she comes in just at the right time to sort of pop the balloon a little bit. Kelly, what are your thoughts on the Baroness?
I felt the same way growing up. You know, you watching it, I always hated her because, you know, she's the wedge between Captain and Maria. But watching this again and as adult, and even after, you know, going to school for theater and everything, just being like, oh, I would love to play her someday. But like watching Eleanor Parker's performance in the movie is just so, she's so crafty about it. She's so good with like being bitchy in the moment, but then also you see what she's going through. She's looking out for herself as well,
right?
Because she's like, I am widowed, I have all of this money, I want to find happiness. And I feel like you see her struggle with that as she's in that bedroom scene with Maria. You see how much it's hurting her. You see how much Elsa feels that it's hurting Maria for what she's doing, but in the end she's like, this, I have to do this for myself. And she's so good with playing those like layered emotions, and she's just so fabulous. I never realized how fabulous she is, and her wardrobe is just killer in this movie. And she just does it all with such like poise, and she's so fantastic. And I remember reading in some of the, or watching some of the documentaries, the cast was talking about how she had this whirlwind romance with a cameraman and ended up just like being swooped off her feet and getting married like really quickly. And the whole cast just always talked about how that was way more compelling of a love story than the one they were actually telling in the movie. But I love that too, that was a whole other story happening behind the scenes, but she's just fabulous.
Yeah, because Eleanor Parker, for our listeners who don't know, she was a leading lady in the 40s and the 50s and actually was an Oscar winner. She won an Oscar for a movie called Caged, which was like the first female prison movie. And she's so very, very different from the Baroness. So it was really kind of a big get to get her to play this part, because it's a smaller part, even though it's, you know, a major part of the plot. But she really makes her mark, Eric.
Yeah, and you know, I love that Kelly said that the Baroness is there driving the wedge between our two main characters. Maria's the other woman. Maria's the one that actually comes into the relationship. And so the way the character is played, though, is we forget that because the Baroness is so bitchy. And yeah, the actress has chops. Not only won an Academy Award, but I think she was nominated a couple of times beyond that too. So, you know, an excellent, as you said, get for this movie. Great, great role.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other characters there's the nuns, which we need to talk about. And, Peggy Wood, who plays Mother Abbess. The only other Oscar nominee from this movie, besides Julie Andrews, she was nominated for supporting actress, but it gives a really solid performance. And Peggy Wood, I think, was in her 70s when she did this, and she had been, she had been acting since like since the turn of the century, the early 1900s. So, yeah, very, very prestigious actress. And, you know, unfortunately, her vocal chops weren't up to doing her own singing for Climb Every Mountain, so she was dubbed. But I think she gives a great performance, because she's stern when she needs to be, and she's compassionate when she needs to be, and she's the catalyst for the whole thing of sending Maria back, well, of sending her in the first place and sending her back. Right. Kelly, what are your thoughts on Mother Abbess?
Yeah, she really is just, you feel the safeness and the genuineness and the motherliness that you, everything you want from the Mother Abbess. And just that she's looking out for Maria, and her scenes with Julie Andrews are so good too. You almost want her to be like, tell me what to do with my life. Tell me how to fix my life too, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric.
Yeah. And I love how you put that, Kelly. I mean, there's the scene at the end of the movie where Maria hugs her and just calls her mother, not Mother Abbess. And it's like, oh yeah, that is Maria's mother, and played very well that way. All of the nuns are great throughout the movie. Love the ending of this movie where they're confessing to Mother Abbess that they have sinned, and they pull out the car parts with their greasy hands. Just great, great stuff.
It's, you know, great.
You owe some of that to the script, but just performed really well too.
Yeah, I was thinking about during the wedding scene, I'm like, you know, Maria doesn't have any family. You know, the nuns are her family. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it really is amazing. There's only one other nun I want to point out, and it's Sister Sophia, who's played by a woman named Marnie Nixon. And if you don't know her name, you certainly know her voice, because She was known as a ghost singer in Hollywood, and so she didn't get credit, but she was a famous dubber, and she dubbed the voices of Deborah Carr in The King and I, of Natalie Wood in West Side Story, and most famously Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. And there was a little bit of tension that people thought was going to happen because famously, Julie Andrews created the role of Eliza Doolittle on Broadway, and a lot of people felt she was cheated out of doing the role in the movie. And so they thought, well, the woman who did the singing for that role, you know, in the movie was on the same set as Julie Andrews, and there might be some friction. But apparently Julie Andrews walked right up to her, put out her hand and said, Marnie, I'm a big fan of yours, and all the tension was gone. So so that was, yeah, that was, yeah, just so the one bit of friction that could have happened, Julie Andrews wonderfully just put it aside. So let's move on, though. Let's talk about scenes and musical numbers, and we could go on and on. But Kelly, what's one of your favorites?
One of my favorites. I would have to say, this is probably the same as a lot of people, but Edelweiss is probably my favorite song of the whole movie. And I think my favorite scene, I have a few, but my most favorite, I think, is the scene in the gazebo right before the captain and Maria are finally together. Kind of piggybacking off of what I said earlier, I just love the way Christopher Plummer enters that scene. He's like a 15-year-old boy again, trying to be like, you came back? Did you come back for me? And it's such a cute, adorable back and forth, and just seeing like their whole arc come together, and the scene with them in the gazebo. And I mean, there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff of why they were giggling so much during that scene, but like they I think it helped so much because you see them being giddy together, you see them finally being happy together, and there's
and they're so they're so close together in that scene, I can't imagine.
Oh my God, yeah, when they talk about the behind scenes, like, they weren't even, yeah. Go ahead, Eric.
There's an amazing lighting effect in that scene, too.
Oh, yeah.
Where Maria is lit in the yellow light and Captain Von Trapp in the pale moonlight. And it's just, it's an amazing shot, too, from a cinematography perspective as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just to piggyback off that, that song, Something Good, was written just for the movie, and I can't imagine it without, so I feel cheated when I don't hear it when I go see the stage version. But it was written by Richard Rodgers alone because Oscar Hammerstein died just shortly after the Broadway show opened. And so Richard Rodgers wrote both Something Good and I Have Confidence for this movie. And you feel like they were always there. They're just perfect in there. And Kelly, just to go off of Edelweiss, that's the last song Oscar Hammerstein ever wrote the lyrics for. And it's amazing, you know, out of all that he had written, such a simple song was sort of his last gift to the world. But yeah, you're right. And it's amazing. You feel like it's an Austrian folk song, but it's not. It's a Broadway creation, but it sounds so perfect. It sounds perfect.
Yeah, it does. It makes you feel like home. There have been Austrian people who have said they've come to America and people will sing Edelweiss to them, and then they get offended when they don't know what it is, because a lot of people who watch the movie don't understand that it's not an Austrian folk song. So it's just, yeah, it feels so authentic.
Yeah, Eric, what's one of your favorites?
I think one of the things that separate the movie from the musical really well is the Do-Re-Mi number. To do that on the stage, it's got to be kind of static. Even if you have the kids kind of moving around and marching and dancing and stuff like that, they went completely other direction. And they said, we're going to utilize Salzburg. We're going to utilize the mountains. We're going to utilize bicycles. And we're going to shoot this thing in all these different little segments. And, you know, the bicycles are going to be choreographed so that they're moving at these different paces. We're going to use the staircases and have them hop around like notes on a scale. It's a clinic on how to shoot a movie musical. I mean, this is what you want to do. Use what you can. And in a movie, it's everything. And so they did that. And you could watch that sequence over and over again and find different things in it every time too, because you've got these eight different components going on all the time.
I don't know that there's ever been another movie that has used a location as well as this movie uses Salzburg, because it's all over and you feel like you've been there after the movie. And
can we stop a second here? Because we mentioned him in passing, but Robert Weiss, who directed this film, and won the Academy Award for this and won the Academy Award for West Side Story. Uh-huh. He's not talked about in the canon of great directors. No. And it is a crime. And I think it's because, sure, those were two movie musicals that he won awards for, but he was so eclectic. He did so many different styles of film that people couldn't pin him down to one thing. And I think he is probably up there in the top, you know, in the classic genre. You know, he may be top 10, top five movie directors of all time. And he's not talked about that way.
He was
if you question it, watch Sound of Music. Yeah.
Well, and he was the editor on a little movie called Citizen Kane.
So maybe I'm biased. That's my favorite movie, Kelly. So.
Got it.
So yeah, but yeah, I mean, and it showed the way that Doremi is edited, and like you know, it shows the passage of time so well. Mm-hmm. You know, and with me, I've got to give you know the opening scene. I mentioned it, but it's one of the greatest opening scenes in movie history, because you have that gorgeous aerial shot of Austria, and then all of a sudden you hear the orchestra. It's like an overture, and they're tuning up, and it pans and pans, and until you know it finally cuts in on Julie Andrews in the meadow and the orchestra swells. I mean, it couldn't have been directed better. And
I was watching it this time and I'm like, where'd they get the drone?
Yeah.
They didn't have drones in 1964, 65 when they shot this thing. That was
a helicopter.
I think it was actually probably an airplane with one of those dome cameras that they would control through there. So, yeah. I mean, truly a technical achievement.
And Kelly, you might know better than I would, but didn't Julie Andrews get flattened many times?
Sure did. Yeah, sure did. She said there was a cameraman strapped in, but then like his equipment was strapped to him. He was hanging out the side of the door where the door to the helicopter is supposed to be. And she said she would wait at the far end of the field, and they had doing it, but they would swell the music and the helicopter would be coming at the other end, and they would yell Julio, and then she would like start walking from her end, and then the helicopter would come by, swoop down towards her like as she comes to do the turn, and then as she finishes the turn, that's where the cut would happen. But when the helicopter came by to circle around and then go back to where they were going, it created this intense downdraft, and like she got flattened into the ground every single time. And she said they did that like 8 or 10 times. They did that take, and she got so mad because she was like, does no one not see me just completely being flattened to the ground? So she kept like trying to tell them like, it's when you turn around. And they thought she was just saying, all right, I'm good to go again. And like, she's just like, I ended up just being sore, but it was all good. But yeah, I just thought that was so funny. She's like, I literally got flattened to the floor every time.
Yeah, and then another number that shows the passage of time well, even though it's not as long as Do Re Mi, but I love the way I Have Confidence is shot, because it's a perfect way to get her from the Abbey to the captain's house. But I just love the way that whole thing is shot, and it starts with one of my favorite quotes from any movie, and it's the when God closes a door somewhere, he opens a window, which is used, mm-hmm. you know, a couple times through the movie. But you know, just from, you know, when she's shot in silhouette to when she starts walking out, and you know, everything in between, it's beautifully done. And there's a cameo by the real Maria von Trapp right behind her in that scene when she's standing in the archway, so that's a fun thing to look out for too. But you know, Kelly, you mentioned it in the beginning, but there are some scenes that are very different from the Broadway show, and we can talk about that. But I love the way that they decided to utilize My Favorite Things in this movie, because in the Broadway show, it's sung by the mother, Abbess and Maria, but they used it as her bonding tool for the kids, and it's perfectly done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's where Lonely Goat Herd is in that slot in the stage version. And it's funny because now Lonely Goat Herd, from productions I've seen or friends who've done productions of it, that's a song that gets cut a lot in the stage version. I find people are like, I don't like that song, let's get rid of it. I personally have always loved that song. But yeah, I love the way that they make it a bonding experience for her. And it's originally between her and Mother Abbess right after how do you solve a problem like Maria before she heads off? And I think this is just, I think it's the perfect place. And it makes, to me, it makes more sense than Lonely Goat Herd, because this is a way, is a tool for them to help him in the future. And yeah, I feel like it's a better switch for sure.
Yeah, because I forget who it was. Somebody argued, they said, but she and the kids are doing a song before she even teaches the kids how to sing. And they're like, ah, but you notice she's the only one who sings in that song. So it actually did make, it actually did make perfect sense. The other big notice, and it's not a musical number, but in the Broadway show, Rolf at the end lets them get away when he sees Liesl as part of the group, but they did an incredibly dramatic, wonderful thing with, you know, the final showdown between him and the captain, and him, you know, and the captain getting in, you know, that you'll never be one of them. And then Rolf turns them in, and it's a great final button for that character, and, you know, gives Rolf really something meaty at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. The same way, if we're like scenes that have been altered in the stage version, Brigida is actually the one who points out to Maria that her and the captain are in love, and then she's told that before even So Long Farewell. So it's like in the stage version, I feel like it's this whole other layer of So Long Farewell for Maria, because not only is she watching the children say goodbye, but that's the moment where I feel like she's decided, where she's like, I have to go. And then in the movie, we know as the Baroness Elsa is the one who is making her go, and she's become that villain, and she's not so much that villain in the stage show.
Yeah. Eric, do you have another favorite scene or something that pops out?
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about this after I watched this movie again, in that it's long, but it's got very little fat on it.
I mean, moves. So
yeah, it moves. All the scenes in this are well thought out and how they're placed too. But I mentioned it briefly too. I think the 16 going on 17 scene is just, it's really well shot. Apparently that was a technical achievement too. It took 4 days to get the lighting right on that, and, you know, have rain and a nighttime scene and two characters moving around this gazebo in that way. But it's just it's a really great sort of B story with those two characters that you mentioned, Brandon, gets buttoned up at the end really well.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the Lonely Goat Herd, and I, you know, it's a silly song, but the marionette work in that number is great. I'm sure that that's professional marionettes doing the harder stuff, but it looks like they're operating it on their own, some of the stuff.
Yeah, the children were taught, like, the basics of the marionette work, and so that they could shoot them, like, knowing like they knew what they were doing, and then they were like, then the other people handled the more intense stuff. But yeah, the puppets themselves are just so incredible. Yeah, it's such a cool scene.
Yeah, what's another one of your favorites, Kelly? There's a ton of stuff here.
Oh my gosh. What's funny is the I Have Confidence was one of my favorite songs growing up, and then once I became an adult, and then when I read Juliander's book, how she was like, that was one of my least favorite songs, and it was actually Richard Rodgers wrote a version of it, and it was too slow. The producer Saul Chaplin, I believe, was the producer. Yep. And he had like a lot of knowledge of music and had, you know, musical capabilities and stuff. And so he took the remnants of songs left over that hadn't been used, or bits that hadn't been used, and pieced together I Have Confidence, and then kind of crafted it himself. And Julie Andrews talks in her book about how he waited a really long time to tell her that he had done that, because he was afraid of what her reaction would be. And she was kind of like, rightfully so, because she was like, it was like one of my least favorite songs. I didn't really know how to make sense of the words, because they were kind of all over the place. And so me and the choreographers sat and talked about how I would just be so nervous about my job that I would just become so flaily. And that's just when I started like skipping and swinging my suitcases and like doing all of these random things. But like when I was a kid, I was like, this song is so fun, all these fun words, and she's like running around and skipping. And but I have still have a fond place for it in my heart now. But yeah, I see what she means by that. But I'm trying to think one of my other favorite songs of hers. honestly, The Lonely Goat Herd was always one of my favorites because I always wished I could yodel. And I couldn't, yodel. And then when I found out Julie Andrews couldn't yodel either, I felt better about myself.
Yeah, apparently that was the real Maria von Trapp only note for Julie Andrews. When she came to visit the set, she said, "You're not a good yodeler."
Like Julie Andrews being so perfect, she was like, "Well, I've been trained my whole life to not have a break in my voice." Yeah. So I can't put the break back in. It's just like, that must be so hard for you. Must just be,
right.
That must be such a terrible thing to deal with. But yeah, I sang that. Me and my mom would sing that song a lot growing up. So
it's definitely an earworm too. I mean, I can hear it. And that's one of those songs that'll pop in there and I'll stay in there for a few hours. And you're like, why The Lonely Goat Herd? But it's just, it's a catchy number.
Yeah. you know, the other section of the movie I love is the party at the end of the first act when you know, the kids are looking in and, you know, and then Maria teaches Kurt, you know, the Landler, and then Captain Von Trapp comes out. You know, it's a wonderful scene, and it just helps cement their relationship. And then, of course, it all builds up to So Long Farewell and Maria leaving. It's just a great end to the first act, and it just builds up so well because you have all the characters there in one spot, and you know, it's the first time where we really feel the danger of the Anschluss coming and all of that, and it's just a great little set piece that builds everything up to what we get in the second act.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on, though, as we kind of do our wrap-up stuff here. So I was checking. The budget for the movie was $8.2 million, and it grossed $286.2 million. And this is 1965 money.
Not a bad return, though.
No. And what's amazing is the movie did okay when it first came out, but it was word of mouth and it kept on building. And apparently it played continuously from 1965 to 1969. It played in theaters continuously for 4 years.
Unbelievable.
That is amazing. Yeah.
You know, pre-pandemic, 4 weeks was a long run.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. Well, like, I'm trying to think, the last movie that played a lot, I think like Avatar played like a year or something like that. And then Titanic played for like a year and a half. But I mean, it wasn't that rare, but you know, for a movie to last 4 years in a theater. And like I said, it did surpass Gone with the Wind, and it really, it saved 20th Century Fox. 20th Century Fox was about to go bankrupt when they made this movie because 2 years before they had thrown so much money into Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And Cleopatra made a good amount of money, but it was never going to make back its budget because they had thrown so much money into it. And 20th Century Fox didn't think they could recover. And it took this movie that had been sitting on their shelf for like 5 years. And little did they know, this little movie that could is what saved the fortunes of 20th Century Fox. So who knew? But it's just amazing. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong here too, Brandon. It was not critically acclaimed when it first came out either.
It was mixed.
Most people said it was a kid's movie, basically, and it was saccharine sweet. So they probably were sweating a little bit until it got some traction and realized that they had a hit on their hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's funny is that Christopher Plummer and Julie Andrews both hesitated to do the movie because they didn't know how sugary sweet it was going to be, and they didn't want it to be that. Mm-hmm. And it was less sugary than the stage musical, but critics still said when it came out, they were just like, this isn't real. And this is, and I mean, I see what they're saying, but for the time and for wanting to create a movie that was going to be widely accepted by all, I feel like this did push those boundaries to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's near as sugary sweet as people make it out to be, if you really pay attention to it. And I know that one of the big concerns that they had was when you have this gorgeous scenery plus all this music, it really will be sugary sweet. But they said the weather in Austria really helped them out because apparently Austria is like the 11th rainiest country in the world. Mm-hmm. So instead of having just consistently blue skies all the time, you had these cumulus clouds that hung over everything and gave real texture to the movie. So what could have been just a sunshiny movie really has a very textured, condensed look to it. And so I think that helps too.
Well, and I think it works because there's there's lots of layers there too. Uh-huh. I mean, there are certainly things that will appeal to kids and could make it a kid's movie, but then you've also got Nazi flags flying in this movie. So there's lots of real layers to it as well, and pulled off well.
I read when this movie played in Germany for like the first few years, they removed the entire third act because they didn't like the Nazi symbolism at the end, which was interesting to me. And also, Austria didn't know they were necessarily comfortable with the production hanging Nazi flags, because we're only 20 years after World War II when they're making this, so wounds were still fresh. Sure. And I can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, even to this day, like, they have the tour that you can go on in Salzburg, but like, residents and like Austria of Salzburg and Austrians like overall don't really know the Sound of Music. It's not something that they pride themselves on, because they're like, you played us all out to be Nazis and our whole country wasn't Nazis, and so they don't like the way that they're portrayed in the movie. And it's crazy that no one there knows about it, really. It was just performed for the first time a few years ago, I think like in 2012 or something like that. Wow. The musical had never been on stage in Austria or Salzburg until then. So
wow. Well, 10 Oscar nominations, and it won 5. It won for Best Picture, Best Director for Robert Wise, Film Editing, Best Score, and Best Sound. Julie Andrews was nominated for Best Actress. She won the year before for Mary Poppins, so it was a pretty good bet she wasn't going to get it for this one. Peggy Wood was nominated for Supporting Actress. The Art Direction was nominated. Cinematography and Costume Design were the other nominations. So a pretty good run. Yeah, I am surprised that Plummer wasn't included. You know, the winner that year was Lee Marvin and Cat Ballou. And it's just, it's a funny performance, but it's not, you know, it's rare when they give an Oscar for comedy, but right. It's strange. And there was a lot of other great dramatic performances that year too. So I don't know exactly what they were thinking, but.
And Christopher Plummer is still acting, you know, he is, yeah. Knives Out years ago. So I don't think it diminished his career very much.
Oh, no. So, but it was great. Yeah. And then, let me see. I like, and when the American Film Institute did the list of the top 100 movies in 1998, it was number 55. And then in 2007, when they did a 10th anniversary list and re-voted, it went up 15 slots. It went up to number 40. So, and then it's number 41 on the most inspirational movies of all time, number 4 on the greatest movie musicals of all time, and number 27 on the greatest love stories of all time. And then in 1998, it was added by the Library of Congress to the National Film Registry. So the critics were wrong, I guess, when they did that.
Well, I think this movie, it holds up really well.
Oh, yeah.
It stands the test of time. And that 15 slot movement, maybe because it was really readily available for a lot of people. When they show it on TV as often as they did,
sure.
It just kind of seeps into the public consciousness. And now people may be like, I haven't seen that in a long time. Brandon, you mentioned it. You haven't watched the movie straight through in a number of years. So going back and getting some perspective on it, you're like, wow, this movie is actually a lot better than I remember. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we sort of wind down here, Kelly, we will start with you. What are your final thoughts on The Sound of Music, and what do you think its legacy is?
Final thoughts. I think The Sound of Music is always going to be around. I think it is. Yeah, it's a story that's going to hold up. It has history in it. And it's, you know, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein, so you have those classic songs. And I also think it's definitely, especially the stage show, if it's going to, you know, keep getting done everywhere, is you can take it and you can make it more sugary sweet for your audience, or you can take it and get real gritty and get down to the troubles that this family was going through. And I love the range of that. And I think because of that, I think it's going to be around for a long time too. Regional houses are going to continue to do the stage show. And now, you know, there's a little bit of freedom and liberty with switching around the songs because of the movie now, and so people try to make it a little bit more like the movie. I think the cast too, like you have Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer, who are two well-known actors who are going to be well-known for a very long time after this. So I think that alone also is helping to carry the movie as well for people to keep watching it. And just there have been people who have said too, when they watch it, it's like, if you don't learn one lesson, you learn another lesson. And there's just so many layered things to take away from it, whether you're 10 years old or 85. So yeah, I think because of that, it'll be around for a long time.
Yeah. Eric.
Yeah. Well said. I think, there's going to be people that are like, Sound of Music, that's not my cup of tea. Got to go back and watch it again, because like you said, Kelly, there's way more lessons in this movie than you probably remember, and there's new things that you'll discover. And that's probably why it's stood the test of time. All of the parts work. We said it doesn't have, slow moments, dull moments in it. It's an entertaining film. And it's an important work. It's a shame it took us a couple of years to get around to it. I'm glad we did.
Yeah. After the year we just came off of, we need something a little hopeful right now. And this is a movie about finding hope and about finding joy, no matter what your circumstances, and about rising above the circumstances that you're put in, and bravery and courage. And, we just came off of a really, really rough year. And so I think The Sound of Music is a perfect antidote. I think we need a little icky sweet right now. So, it's one of the jewels in the Rodgers and Hammerstein catalog. And I think it always will be. It's timeless. It doesn't age. It'll always be fresh. And so I think now more than any time is the perfect time to rediscover it. So glad we got around to it. And Kelly, I'm glad you joined us. This was great.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks for having me. This is one of my favorite movies ever. And I will talk to anyone for as long as you let me to about this movie. So I had like 6 pages of notes for this, and I didn't probably say like half the things I had like prepared. But that's just because I'm a huge nerd. Thank you again for letting me chat with you guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So do you have anything that you would like to plug? I know that you have a little small business.
I do have a small little online crochet shop that I've been working on during the pandemic. As we all know, there's no theater or acting work at the moment. Blissful Betty on Facebook or Blissful Betty Shop on Instagram. I do custom orders. I have a few things on my Etsy site. If you want to check that out, that would be awesome. Otherwise, hopefully we'll see each other in this next year doing some sort of wonderful art somewhere. Yeah. And sync up for that.
Yes, absolutely. So as we move on from here for the month of January, we've got some fun stuff coming up. We do want to celebrate the 70th anniversary of another great movie musical, An American in Paris. And hopefully we have a special guest coming up with us. I haven't made all the final arrangements, but hopefully we'll have more of that coming soon. And then we'll have another special episode just for our feed. And then coming up in February, Aaron McCabe with The Front Row is going to join us to talk about Annie Hall, one of the great comedies from the 70s. So looking forward to that. And just a lot more. We're still stuck at home for a few months, so let's make the best of it at least. And if you want to give us a review at iTunes, go ahead and do it. You can find us Front Row Classics Podcast on Facebook, FRN Classics Pod on Instagram, and email us at frnclassics@gmail.com if you want to suggest a movie. Kelly suggested Sound of Music to me, so I'm really easygoing. If you suggest something, we'll do it. And as long as it was made before 1980, otherwise our friends at Front Row Flashbacks get testy. So we will.
Very testy. They're short with us.
They are very short with us. So we'll stay out of their territory. But otherwise, so looking forward to 2021 and all that it has to offer. So for the Front Row Network, I am Brandon Davis.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And I'm Kelly Lorenz.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.